Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and here we are to talk about, I'd say, the most interesting and hip book I've read this summer, which is Lydia Millett's book, Fight No More. It's said that it's a book of stories. It's said that it's a book of connected stories. The book flap says it best. It's a web of stories, and stories in it connect in the most unpredictable ways, and sometimes they don't. It's set in Los Angeles between an older generation of Angelenos who are living in their very expensive houses with their chandeliers, and a younger generation who are driving around in expensive cars bought by their parents who have no idea of how to live, who are living a kind of wild life, who've gotten used to almost everything, and that getting used to, I think, is signaled in the title, which is Fight No More. Everyone has given up the battle, and they're all living an improvised life as catch-as-catch-can, just as the connection of these stories seems improvised as well. Now tell me, when did you know that this book wasn't a novel, or that it was interconnected? What kind of writing process was this? Because this is surely the most original collection of short stories that I've read in years.
Well, that is extremely kind of you to say. So it was improvised, and you're the first one to name that. But it was improvised. It just started with the first story you read. And then I just kept sort of tracking out from there because I wanted to follow small leads or impulses. And so it went where it went.
You're crazy, you know.
Thank you.
Husbands are breaking up from wives. So suddenly, the expensive houses that the wife has perhaps become used to need to be sold so that she can continue to live. But her child, of whom she has custody, doesn't know how to live outside the expensive house. It feels like a terrible betrayal. And another woman, who's trying to put a new house together, discovers that there are seven dwarves there to help her, painting the walls, fixing her food. Even at work, they put a picture of her on top of a picture of Disney's Snow White so that everyone will understand. And she herself has to move out because her house becomes too crowded. No one's been able to live around seven men.
It's a tall order, so to speak. Didn't mean to pun, but yeah.
Yeah, they do get taller.
They get taller
overnight.
That can be threatening.
It's really kind of an amazing book because anything can happen. This story can be hilarious and fantastical. The next story, very sad. And really, you are dealing with these characters, these stories, these forms, as if they were a pack of cards. Songs, music, seems to play an important role in this book. What is it?
Well, and it would play even a more important role if I could get away with inserting more lyrics without accusations of copyright infringement. I really love having songs, song lyrics, snatches of pieces in my books, but it's sort of hard to pull off legally these days. But the way I started the book actually was thinking that I was going to write about not real estate specifically or homes specifically, but actually the way in which avant-garde art and sort of rebel art and stuff that's shocking when it first is made, how that gets commodified and just assimilated into consumer culture. That was really sort of what started me out on the first story. So I had the Marquis de Sade and Jeff Koons and stuff like that in that story. But that became too cerebral feeling to me as I moved through them. And the artifact, so I moved away from that and into sort of the personal and the class and that kind of thing. But there are artifacts of that throughout, which are bits of subversive art sort of sprinkled in the stories.
There are two stories in particular where a bad boy and a bad girl are each speaking their particular language of upheaval and naughtiness. Mm-hmm. And you wrote one for a man, one for a woman. You wrote two of the most painful stories I've ever read. The boy is being completely disinherited by the father, who's now married to what he calls the child bride. Mm-hmm. And his friend is working as an au pair, and she's been being molested by her stepfather for 4 years now, and she is revolted by it, but has been initiated into the language and behavior of sexual abuse. I would assume rewriting these stories meant writing them until they'd be shocking and disturbing to any reader, as well as laughter-provoking, because we are used to an aberrant universe now.
I think we are. I mean, I think it's really hard to shock readers now, don't you? I mean, there is one story in here that's very graphic, and I haven't heard about it. I haven't gotten any blowback for it. It's a graphic pedophile story, basically, you know, and no one's really raised the kind of objection I feel they might have back in the day. I don't know.
I think it's because they're not sure. They're not sure whether to be angry, embarrassed, shocked, delighted. But you are leaping into the fray. My guest is Lydia Millett. The book is Fight No More. In a world of books that are being written out of what people talk about at writing programs, you are writing a book about our times. And all kinds of language are appropriate and inappropriate. You really managed, I'll say it directly, to shock me sometimes, and then 2 pages later, make me laugh. The first story features a black man. The real estate agent thinks that he must be an African dictator. No, he's not. He's a songwriter.
Right.
But a very phobic songwriter. And the people with him are not his slaves or servants or helpers. They're his band members.
Right.
And everything, as we read the story, keeps being redefined. Now, did that happen because it was being revealed to you as you wrote it?
Yeah, you know, I've told you, I think before, I don't really premeditate any of my writing. And so I always just am discovering things along with the reader, pretty much. I write just to delight myself and stop myself from being bored. And so, yeah, things happen to me as a writer as I go along. And really nothing was designed consciously.
Now tell me, what is Fight No More? Is that the name of a song?
Actually, that's just the tail end of that famous quote from Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce when he surrendered to the white man, basically, in I think it was 1877, maybe. So at the end of the battle, those were his, you know, he had this famous quote that sometimes people claim he didn't actually say. But and it was just, from now on, I shall fight no more forever.
Wow. And these people are living what I think of as the most laissez-faire, shocking lives that I've seen in a book since Portnoy's Complaint.
Wow.
I may be exaggerating here because I've just been rereading Philip Roth mm-hmm. after his, well, very timely death. But this is a book that's fun like that. Now, should a book be fun?
Well, I think so. But it should not be only fun. So a book that's only fun to me is usually glib or usually overly clever and sometimes risks shallowness. So I no longer wish to write books that are only fun.
And this book is, I think, your 11th book.
Or it might be my 12th book. I'm not sure. You could be right.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You're right.
Okay.
It's your 12th book. It's Fight No More. It's published as the last several have been by Norton. Even I'm prepared for what Lydia Millett does, but I wasn't prepared for this book. Did it surprise you as much as it surprised me, to the extent that you can answer a question like that?
I guess I was surprised enough to keep writing it, because I need to surprise myself as I'm going along to stay engaged with something. And but I can't say overall that I stood back and was startled. I mean, I always just want to do a new thing when I write a book. Otherwise, why write another book is my feeling. But so I tried to do a new thing with these stories. But also, I can't lie, you know, I was pretty much procrastinating from writing a novel that I was not succeeding in. And so the stories were just a playground for me. And I think sometimes it's helpful to go into something like it's a playground and not like it's a schoolroom or something.
Now, I guess I will ask you to read from the first page of the book.
Sure.
Because you'll see immediately how scrappy, ready to go anywhere, it is. This is from a story called Libertines. Most of the time, we know the word libertines from the men in the Marquis de Sade's novels. And again, in this book, most of the men have never read the Marquis de Sade, but they are libertines.
Yeah, that's the idea. Libertines. She stood for a moment in the quiet bathroom, in its stillness that was like a held breath. Then she opened the book, sat down on the toilet, and let a line of type catch her eye. Supper and the orgies transpired without unusual incident. Disappointing. A page without graphic sex. She only had a couple of minutes till the showing, though, so she closed the book and swiveled it back into position on the shelf over the bidet. Not the first time she'd hid out in a bathroom all furtive. When she was a kid, the neighbors two doors down had kept a copy of The Joy of Sex in a basket beside their toilet. They had an orange shag rug on their toilet lid. The book featured line drawings of naked old people with nests of curly hair around their private parts. Seeing those pictures, her little sister screamed. After they discovered it, the two of them used to find any excuse to go pee in that house. Sometimes they'd claimed their own toilet was clogged. Later, when they were in their 20s, her sister denounced the book at someone's bridal shower. "Groovy sex is worse than no sex at all," she'd said. That was before she stopped drinking and turned to self-help.
Yes, groovy sex is worse than no sex at all. We've entered a world where nothing can be easily assimilated. Not generations, not sexual behaviors, not what is the norm and is no longer the norm. People have obscene art. They keep their copies of 120 Days of Sodom by the toilet in the bathroom where they once used to keep a joke book. You know,
yeah.
This is a book being written full of an awareness that we're living in the Donald Trump years, and what we hope is just the Donald Trump term, but who knows what it's going to be. And things we do know, whatever happens, are going to get wilder and wilder and wilder, you know, because something happens to a culture if it doesn't have its public libraries, if no one is reading, if no one understands that immorality didn't come from nowhere. There's a tradition of the immoral.
Right.
Now, again, once you'd finished your web of stories, and web is particularly good because the characters are trapped like flies in the spider's web, did you rework it? Did you give it more of a shape?
I did not. I added one story at the request of maybe Elizabeth, my publicist. I don't know who it was. They just wanted one more story about one particular character. But other than that, no, I didn't really do anything to it. And you're right that it was written You know, a lot of it was written during the election campaign. So while Donald Trump hadn't been elected yet, it was in that climate, in that sort of social and media climate, that it was being written.
And, you know, I personally feel a great relief when I read a book that feels fresh and new. I feel like I may have been reading maybe 10 or 12 books in a row that were the voice of the writing school generation, everyone trying to write the same book. Not the same way, they all write differently, but they're all writing about the same thing. You're making an escape from the known and the acceptable. This is not about young people moving to the big city and trying to start their career. It couldn't be adapted into a television series, although maybe you would want it to be, and it might be a very fun series.
You never know, right?
You never know anymore. And you're writing about the condition of not knowing anymore. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be very pleasant. And so in one of these stories, well, I'll say it, a young woman being abused by her stepfather, by the end of the chapter, he will be dead in her arms. She'll have told him, "You don't look so good," and he is sweating and doing coke and drinking at the same time, and he's finally gotten her where he wants her, and now his heart is full. All he can do is have a heart attack because he's being given everything he wanted. None of it was admirable, enviable, or right. And death is the consequence. And I felt, is it okay? I felt very happy that he was taken out of the mix.
Yeah.
I didn't want him to be alive anymore.
He was a bad guy.
A really bad guy.
But I think also when I wrote that story, I did really want to be in his head. You know, I really wanted to be alongside him in that sort of criminal act.
Now, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Lydia Millett about her book of short stories, which is probably not a book of short stories, but a web of short stories, which is not a web of short stories, but a deconstructed novel, which is not a deconstructed novel, because what is a deconstructed novel? But we do know one thing. It's called Fight No More, published by W.W. Norton, and we'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Lydia Millett about her new book, Fight No More, where a lonely real estate agent is at the center of a set of stories that can be called satirical, but they might just as well be called transgressive. And I'd say that it's been years since there have been stories that are genuinely transgressive. Transgressive just became an adjective that became a popular way of describing something that went to unpleasant places. This is not so much unpleasant. I would say it's a report on the way we live now. And that is what writing is supposed to be. This is a book which, as you read it, and I hope you will tell you that you're not wrong about what you're thinking when you look around you, that all of this thing is happening, you're not hallucinating, and what are you going to do about it?
I like that.
The best adult in this book does something about it in the final chapter, and watching her go to work took my breath away, Lydia. I thought she was fabulous. What's her name?
Aleska.
Aleska.
Yeah, she's an older scholar of the aesthetics of fascism. And yeah, she takes matters into her own hands a bit.
Yes, and she shows that she can, that she is not a weakling, that she may be living now in someone's guest house, her son's guest house, but she is not a powerless figure, that her judgments, she knows, are accurate, and she knows how to act on them. And this book, full of people who fight no more, this is a woman who's just starting to fight. And it's very important not to surrender, not to give up, to keep in action. Otherwise, we sit back and passively watch what's valuable to us.
Yeah, Aleska worries very much that her son is not a good man, that she's raised him in this land of plenty after losing her own family in the Stalin purges, and almost by giving him too easy a childhood that she's ruined him. And she no longer likes him at all. He's just a kind of callous and self-serving businessman. He's more just a sort of model of maybe vaguely subclinical narcissism. He's just all about the self. And I often write about characters who are just about the self. And it's one of the things that preoccupies me about the culture. And as you said, particularly in this moment, the sort of just the self-centric quality of all our doings and everything we look at and everything we put into the world, the sort of solipsistic quality of the way we live.
Now, what is it like for a writer to write about behaviors in life that she doesn't admire, that she doesn't like, that she doesn't approve of?
Well, I've always, it's empathy. I can never really distance myself from whatever I'm writing. I always feel as though it's my own gestures or my own impulses, even if they seem, borderline evil. I always can identify with that. It's true that I flatter myself I'm not a sexual predator, but that doesn't mean that I can't empathize with one.
It's interesting to me because sometimes I've wondered whether life in America, well, maybe globally, I don't know globally, but maybe life in America is becoming so dispiriting that it's harder than ever to write about. And as a result, we're seeing a lot of writing that's not quite about anything, because we all want, when we sit down to write, to enter the world of the imagination, the world where writing saves us from the worst that seems to be lying in wait for us. So do you ever feel hesitant? Because you're pretty out there, Lydia.
I don't know what you mean.
I think
I'm very straightforward, very simple.
Yes, but you're writing about things that people find it hard to say, to acknowledge, even to see. I mean, if we were to really, if a short story writer, novelist, what have you, were to ask and answer the question, what do young people learn in school today? And what do they use it for? And what was it meant to be used for? And is it in fact valuable? And is it still worthwhile for a child to pay all that money, his own or family's, her own or family's? Is it worth the investment?
I think education is all we have, I think it's our last hope.
I hope so. I think reading is all we have. I'm not sure that the way things are taught in school is as good as reading what have you, reading Plato, reading, you know, there are so many, reading Desaad for that
matter. But don't you think that now more than ever we need people, older people generally, to filter out for younger people somewhat what is worthy of being read? Because there's so much content everywhere, and how can you even have, you know, an aesthetic compass, much less a moral one, as a young child? I mean, it's just everywhere. There's an abundance of vile content, you know? I think still people need guidance as to what has already existed, what exists in the world already, what is beautiful that has already been made, you know, to point people toward it. Even if reading's your beacon, you know, there has to be someone helping you. I'm always grateful for the help that an ex-boyfriend gave me when I was in my 20s, just this excellent reading list that a professor of his at USC had given him that wasn't canonical, but that was brilliant and funny and difficult books, you know, and I've never learned more than I did from reading those novels.
Well, Lydia, I hope you'll forgive me if I say that that's what I've always hoped that Bookworm would be for. That when I meet people now, this show has been on for 33 years, when I meet people now who tell me I've been listening to you from the time I was able to read on, I think, what an honor to have been given in this amazing American city, Los Angeles, the voice mm-hmm. of literature.
Yeah, it is an amazing job that you have, actually. And we're fortunate that, you know, that it exists, because I think it's harder and harder to find things that are good out there in the maelstrom.
And I'm always looking, I've got to tell you, I'm always looking for a Lydia Millet. And the nice surprise of, I already thought I knew Lydia Millet, but I wasn't prepared for this book. Thank goodness a good writer is always surprising us. That's the function.
I'm glad.
I've been talking with Lydia Millet, author of Fight No More, published by W.W. Norton and Company. Thank you, Lydia, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from Apple Podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. We're not choosy. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Michelle Escobar. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Thanks again to my valuable assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Christian Kroft is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.